Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. As always, the week in national politics couldn't be busier, and so much to talk about where things have been, where things are going. Joining me, Brad Bannon, Democratic strategist and the president of Bannon Communications Research returns. Brad, welcome back. Always good to get your insights.
It's always a pleasure, Paul. Thanks for having me on.
This week the president had his first press conference. His first cabinet meeting, and he opened it with a statement about no president has accomplished more. Maybe with a few exceptions, he mentioned FDR. He might concede to Lincoln, but no president has accomplished more than he has in this amount of time in his presidency. So let me turn it over to you, and if you would, you can walk through all of his accomplishments.
Well, that wouldn't take very long, actually. If you look at his legislative record, is a lot more meager than Barack Obama's was, for example. In the first 100 days of Barack Obama's presidency, he got Congress to pass a massive economic stimulus bill to revitalize the economy, renewed the Child Health Care Act, and also got Congress to pass the Lilly Ledbetter Act, which provided pay equity for women.
So in fairness,
the only legislative accomplishment that Donald Trump has is that he got the Senate to ratify his nominee for Supreme Court Justice. But other than that, not one of his major initiatives has got through Congress yet. His health care bill especially is lingering in the Senate after a very tough go in the House.
And I want to talk to you about some of those specifics. But now, remember, you're a Democrat. But when you look at his accomplishments, he would say, we're out of the Paris Accord. I promised you that. In other words, you may not agree with some of the things he's done, but has he been proceeding with the promises he made?
Well, in some ways, yes. I mean, what he has done, he has virtually no record of legislative accomplishment, but he has issued a lot of executive orders, including getting out of the Paris Peace Accords, reversing some of the environmental initiatives that Barack Obama introduced. But everything he's done in terms of executive order is not to go forward, but to reverse things that Barack Obama did. He's taken no new initiatives other than reversing Obama executive orders. And it's also interesting that if you look at the executive orders he's issued, two of them were a ban on travel from six Muslim nations. And both travel bans were rejected by U.S. District Court judges, and also to the Fourth and Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. So even the executive orders he has issued have been nullified by federal courts for being violations of the Constitution.
But all of those, Brad, let's talk about the travel ban for a moment. It'll work its way up to the Supreme Court. That's the only court that really matters. The president keeps saying, let's just get this to the Supremes. And that's because I think he thinks he's got his nine votes. With Neil Gorsuch on the court, we don't know what Justice Gorsuch would do, but let's assume he would take the position desired by the president. It once again puts Anthony Kennedy in the middle.
Well, it does, but it's hard to believe. Usually the Supreme Court will reverse a circuit court ruling when there is more than one circuit court ruling and the circuit court rulings came out differently. But two circuit courts, federal circuit courts, have already ruled, and both courts said it was a violation of the First Amendment. And it's very unusual for the Supreme Court to reverse a decision that has been upheld by more than one circuit court of appeals.
Or if they do, it's certainly going to have a very strong political taint to the decision.
Oh, yes, it will be very strong. But, you know, it seems to me the travel ban has a basic constitutional flaw, which a dozen federal judges have pointed out, and I don't see how the Supreme Court's going to overlook it. And the flaw is that since it targets countries that have majority Muslim populations, every federal judge who's ruled on it said it is a violation of the First Amendment because it uses a religious test to formulate policy.
Well, we're going to move on from that because we'll certainly get an answer on that eventually. Although, again, in order to get to that conclusion, you have to be able to include President Trump's tweets on that matter, which confirm that that's what it's all about. If a Supreme Court were to say we don't want to consider the tweets, we simply want to look at the power of the executive branch, and the president has almost, I won't say unlimited, but extreme power when it comes to immigration issues, you could easily see how the court would go in that direction. The question is whether they want to go with the tweets as being a sign or symbol of the president's actual intent.
Well, yeah, but none of the federal judges who've looked at it so far has ignored the tweet. In fact, the circuit court, the Ninth Circuit Court ruling, cited several of his tweets and also statements he made on during the campaign that essentially said he was using his executive orders. He would use his executive orders to stop immigration from majority Muslim countries. And again, that is a religious test that is prohibited by the First Amendment to the Constitution.
Let's take a look at some of the other issues that the president says he's trying to get through. He says health, and again in his cabinet meeting, health care moving along very, very well, greater speed than anybody can imagine. That's his view on things. There is something notable about how this bill is moving through the Senate, and it's striking. Senator McConnell, majority leader, seems to be suggesting that whatever this bill says, very few people are going to know about it. There's not going to be any hearings about it. It's just going right for a vote.
Well, yeah, that's true. And I think Senator McConnell is making a mistake because that's why the exact reason why the president had such a difficult time getting his health care reform plan through the House. The reality is in health care reform, the more people know about it, the less they like it. And the problem here is any way the McConnell draft bill comes out, It is going to push millions of Americans, perhaps as many as 20 million Americans, without health insurance, and that caused a great uproar among many people when it went through the House, and the same thing is going to happen in the Senate. So Senator McConnell wants to keep the details hidden as long as possible, because when people see the emails, the details, they're going to be horrified.
Well, I don't know if this is a fair question to ask you, but in order to get this through, you only need 51 votes to get it through. And with the vice president, he needs 50 in the Senate. But the purpose for not having the hearings, not talking about it, going to a vote, can he avoid a Democratic filibuster that way? That's the only hope Democrats even have.
Well, the Senator McConnell, the majority leader, has packaged this deal so it's filibuster-proof. The majority leader has the power to basically rule the filibuster out of order when a bill like this one has great budget implications. The problem is that even though there are 52 Republicans in the Senate, there aren't 52 Republicans who support the dissolution of Obamacare. For instance, Jeff Flake of Arizona, Susan Collins of Maine, Heck from Nevada, they all are very leery of abolishing Obamacare. So, you know, right now, McConnell has said this, he doesn't have 50 votes.
So again, he's got to work on his own people. How do you get the votes from your own side when you're not even essentially showing them what the bill says? Let's just trust me, guys. Let's just trust me.
Well, the only way McConnell can get this bill through is basically to eliminate just about all the provisions in the House passed bill. The problem with that is if McConnell comes out with a bill that kills a lot of the House provisions, when the bill goes back to the Senate, Trump won't be able to get it approved there. So health care reform has a very difficult path, and it all revolves around the fact that people are concerned, including many Republican members of the House and the Senate, that you're going to leave 20 million people in the lurch. And that is, and Republicans who are running for re-election next year, such as Senators Flake and Heck, are scared to death. And so are many Republican House members from competitive districts. If you look at the national polls, the Trump care bill that passed the House has, on a good day, 20% approval, with 60-something percent of the American public opposing it. So Republican senators and House members in competitive districts facing tough races next year are scared to death to vote for it.
Let's talk about banking a little bit. It's almost going unnoticed because there's so much other stuff going on in Washington, but Congress is doing its job of essentially dismantling Dodd-Frank. How does that set up the country for banking issues? Dodd-Frank got passed to get us out of the 2008 mess, make sure it could never happen again. Are we just opening the door to that kind of crisis again?
Well, yeah, you're basically, and you're right, it happened without almost anybody noticing, because it happened on the same day that James Comey was testifying before the Senate. The House Republicans killed the Dodd-Frank law. And right now, all the abuses that Wall Street had that created the Great Recession of 2008, all those restrictions on Wall Street using investments as casino gambling will be inoperative if the Senate passes the same bill. But again, you have the question there, will the Senate pass? It's nice it got through the House for the president, but it's going to have a tough time in the Senate.
Taxes? He's talking about great tax change. There's no bill that I've seen that's been presented anywhere. We had Infrastructure Week, the trillion-dollar effort, which seems to be now an effort to have states and municipalities fund the changes, and otherwise will privatize airports and everything else. And this most recently was Workers' Week, where we heard Secretary of Labor saying we need apprenticeships, except they're cutting funding to all of that. It's so hard to follow what direction things are going because they talk about a policy, they don't fund it. What's going on with any of that?
Well, that's the problem. It's a bunch of empty promises because there's no money to back up the president's initiatives. We have breaches all across the country and roads and airports, including in the Chicago area, that are slowly collapsing. And there is no money, there's very little money in the Trump proposal to fix any of those things. And again, it might get through the House, but it will need 60 votes to pass the Senate. And the Trump proposal in the Senate doesn't have anywhere near 60 votes.
When we look at the Comey firing, Jeff Sessions testifying, Dan Coats, all these people testifying, we're getting what we get out of all that. But the bottom line is the real question seems to be, will the president ultimately order the firing of the special counsel? And I say order the firing because a lot of people don't quite understand. He actually doesn't have the power to do that. It would have to be Rosenstein, the acting AG, who would have to do that on those issues. Where does all that go? I mean, if he does get Rosenstein fired, to me it's an upheaval in DOJ, and we're back to the days of Watergate-type massacres with massive political problems.
Well, it is. It will create a political fear that would be disastrous for Republicans. In fact, Lindsey Graham said it would be a grievous mistake. The Republican senator from South Carolina said it would be a grievous mistake for President Trump to fire Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller, and it would be. And again, you know, Trump may not pay the price for any of these problems, but the Republican House members who are in tough races next year are going to pay the price. Right now, the president's job rating is only on the in the high 30s, and that, if history is any guide, that means the Republicans could lose control of the House and up to 50 Republican incumbents. And that's the problem. Trump can do anything he wants, but everything he does endangers the Republican majority in Congress, which is why I think you see many Republicans starting to distance themselves from the president.
As a final thought then, Brad, on the Democratic side, which is where you advise and strategize, you still don't get a sense that the Democrats have the pathway for the future. I mean, it's will they grasp defeat out of the jaws of victory, as they say? Because it looks good for Democrats in 18, but yet Tom Perez, the head of the DNC, I mean, where are they? What are they saying? You know what I'm saying? There doesn't seem to be a coherent message about jobs and the economy. It's what cost Hillary the election. I don't see them grabbing the working person back.
Well, I agree, and the Democrats do need an aggressive job message. In fact, Tom Perez is actively trying to convince Democratic members of Congress to pass their own job program, which would go down in flames because lack of Republican support, but it would send up a policy agenda for the midterms next year.
To be continued and to be watched, Brad Bannon, Democratic strategist and president of Bannon Communications Research. As always, thanks for being with me. Thanks for shedding some light. And we're going to continue to monitor this.
Yeah, there's always a lot to talk about these days, Paul.
Thank you, Brad. That music, it's just one of my favorite shows of all time, Ragtime. I don't know if you've seen it. Maybe you saw the movie Ragtime, maybe you read the book. But the musical Ragtime, which was written by Terrence McNally in terms of the book, and lyrics by Lynn Ahrens, music by Stephen Flaherty, I think it just ranks as one of my all-time favorite musicals. And the good news is it is back, and you can see it at the Den Theater. So that's why I wanted you to know about it, and I also want you to meet part of the cast and the director of the show who joined me now on our podcast. Directing the show, Scott Weinstein, who is returning to the Griffin Theater because he's directed Titanic there and Bat Boy. He's just done so many great shows. And this one, Scott, this one's a challenge. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And also, and I'll tell you, if you know this show, you know there are lots of major characters in there. I think one of the finest performances in this show, among several fine performances in this show, is the role of Tata. We'll explain who that is, but it is masterfully portrayed by Jason Richards, who is actually making his debut with the Griffin Theater over at the Den Theater. You may remember him from the producers at Mercury Theater and Annie Warbucks, Christmas Story, so many great shows, and City of Angels, where a close friend of mine actually started that on Broadway, Greg Edelman. But anyway, Jason Richards, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks so much. I was already dancing to the music.
So was I. Hey, so Scott, let me start. As a director, when I saw that this was coming to the Griffin Theater at the Den Theater, I think that's the proper way to say that, right?
Mm-hmm.
I got very excited because I love the show, but I also thought to myself, this is a big show. This is a show which, you know, on Broadway or a touring cast has about 740 people in it. Exaggeration.
Yeah, close to that.
And an orchestra the size of, you know, the Chicago Symphony, a big show. And I thought, how can they possibly pull this off? You do. And so tell our audience a little bit about how you knew what you had to accomplish and you did it with a smaller number of people and musicians.
Yeah, well, we set out to do this is a very different version of Ragtime than you'll probably have seen. Traditionally, there's about 40 people in the show, and like you said, there's an orchestra that's the size of a small town. Every time I've seen the show, I've been blown away by how epic it is and the scale of it. And revisiting it, I felt like there are a lot of really personal stories in there, and I feel like sometimes those can get lost in large-scale productions. And so my collaborator, Matt Deitchman, who did all the new orchestrations and sort of helped conceive this idea, and I were thinking, how could we do Ragtime with the least amount of things possible, which if you know ragtime is hard because there's one of the requirements is you need a car that comes on stage. And
I was going to bring that up, and you did. You just have the orchestra double for the car.
Yeah, we did, and we decided that at the crux of the show is music as a metaphor for a changing America. And so we thought if music is everything in this play, how can that help us minimize the scale of it without losing the power of it? And so things like are one of the upright pianos in the play becomes the car, and which has symbolism for Colehouse Walker, whose car it is since he is a pianist. But yeah, we decided to see just how little we could do it with, and we distilled it down to basically each of the three groups in the show getting their own musicians. So there is a white pianist at a baby grand, a black pianist at an upright piano, and then there is someone playing reeds and clarinets and what we sort of called carrying instruments that maybe immigrants would have had with them, so that each group is represented by a musician on stage.
And we figured out the
bare minimum amount of people we could do it with, and the cast is working their butts off.
I was really impressed by the fact that some cast members, I have to ask you, did you sort of, it was part of the auditioning process, I need you to play Emma Goldman, but you have to know how to play the violin? I mean, what was...
Right. We originally we'd set out to really only use just the three musicians, and on a whim we sort of asked people, if you play instruments, let us know and bring them in. And we just had such a great turnout of people who could play instruments, and we had inklings of ideas of what we could do if people could play instruments. Like, we had a thought that perhaps there is Tata's deceased wife is represented by someone playing the violin throughout the show, and we had the good fortune of finding Courtney Jones, who is not only a great actress but also an incredible violinist, and so she plays violin throughout the show and adds it in places. And Neela Baron, who plays Emma Goldman, adds in the flute. And so some of it was happy accidents that then became more fleshed out ideas. But we knew we wanted a little bit of that, but we got really lucky with how much we were able to get.
You did, and I love the way you were able to add the symbolism into it. Jason Richards, you play the role of Tata. Let me turn to you to listen. Not everybody knows the story of ragtime. What I love about it is the blending of the real history with some fiction. So tell our listeners a little bit about what the story of ragtime is, and tell us who Tata is.
Yeah, it's a 1998 musical about, you know, the turn of the century. So it begins in 1902 at the turn of the century America, and it's about kind of these three groups that are kind of clashing at, you know, this crazy, tumultuous, changing time in America. So you have the white affluent group represented by father and mother in New Rochelle, New York. And then you have, you know, the very famous ragtime pianist, Colehouse Walker Jr. And then you have my character, who is Tata, who's a Latvian immigrant, you know, coming during the time of the Russian Revolution and, you know, a great time of social upheaval, you know, where he's from. And like Scott was saying, you find out early in the play that his wife passed on. You're never sure how. You're never told how. But he's suddenly this single father, you know, immigrating to America by himself, and just has this fierce need to protect his little girl in this very dangerous place. But the great thing about the character is he's also just he has this, you know, happiness and zest for life, and truly believes in the American dream, you know, every moment, until, you know, when he gets there and kind of it hits him in the face that, you know, it's not everything that, you know, it was cracked up to be.
And Jason, talk for a moment again. We have, you know, Emma Goldman. She's a real historic figure. We've got Harry Houdini. I mean, there are these historic figures, Booker T. Washington. These are figures. So how does that interplay? How important is that to getting the story across? Is it a time establishing? How did you view those roles?
Well, yeah, you have these great fictional characters, but then you have, you know, like Evelyn Nesbit coming through, and, you know, whether or not Evelyn Nesbit has kind of like met Harry Houdini or not, you know, they kind of, you know, are all interconnected in these scenes and kind of like meeting each other and interacting with each other. And so it's kind of like this grand scale of America, you know, but everybody's kind of squished down and kind of meeting each other and running into each other all in one place. So it's great.
It works so well. Scott, the other thing that was critical to me whenever I've seen Ragtime is you have to have those voices blend in a chorus of harmony that is so critical, I think, to the book, and so critical to the sound of that show. And I didn't think you could pull it off. Again, you did. And you do it by sending cast members into the audience to fill that room. By the way, the night I was there, I must have been part of the cast because I happened to be singing along, but that was just me.
Well, thank you. Yeah, we as far as I know, there haven't really been other productions of Ragtime that have been immersive in that way. And that was something that was really interesting to us, is that we wanted to include the America that is coming to see the show in our representation of America, and to engage people in a closer way. There's also, the way that the play is, there's tons of direct address, and we break the fourth wall all the time already. And we felt like, because we were in this such an intimate environment with this version, that it felt silly to not just include our audience in that, and really actually just talk directly to them and really take over this space.
And indeed, there's the number about baseball, of course, where where I was sitting, some cast members were behind me. And I imagine they do this all the time. I don't know. But they were kind of involving us. They were tapping me on the shoulder, making me part of that. That was great. And I was more than happy to I wanted to get up and sing. But I thought maybe I shouldn't. You know, the music of this show is among the most beautiful music, I think, written for Broadway musicals. And I met Stephen Flaherty and Lynn Ahrens. And I told them, I just said, I got to tell you. In fact, they've done other things, but I don't think anything comes close, I'm sorry, but to this masterpiece called Ragtime. And one of the songs in the show, Jason, that you sing, and we do have the track from the show of you, it's called Our Children. And it really is the meeting of immigrants when they come across the well-to-do white folks. But indeed, lines do meet. And let's take a listen to a little bit of the beautiful song called Our Children.
Look, down there, the children.
But that's what that's... She doesn't hear me.
No, she hears me. She doesn't listen.
All children are like that.
What is there, honey?
I'm very glad ours have become such friends. How will they play? Finding treasure in the sand. They're forever hand in hand.
And this song continues to build in that beautiful harmony. But there's so much more to it, Jason, isn't there, as you realize just the power of how the message of that number, that show, resonates today in what's going on.
Yeah, it's fantastic. You know, I was, I hate to say this, but I knew the big numbers in Ragtime before I auditioned for the show. You know, I knew Wheels of the Dream and the prologue and everything, but I didn't get to do a deep dive into it until I was called in for the show. And
oh, you'd never seen the show before?
I'd never seen it, no.
Wow.
And I'd never listened to it all the way through. You know, I knew the big ones. But when I did the was called in for Tata, and I heard Our Children for the first time, you know, I was excited for it. But, I mean, the minute I heard that song, I probably watched, you know, like 100 versions on YouTube within, like, you know, 2 days. And that was when I knew that this is, like, a dream role that I never knew I had. And I'm just every day that I get to sing it, especially with Laura by my side, who's just such a fantastic actress and who's just like with me there for every moment, every night. It's a joy.
Without question, it plays so well. Talk to me a little bit about, Scott, the theme. Mm-hmm. You can't sit through that show today. Like you said, it's set at the turn of the century. It was written in the late 1990s, and yet you watch it today in today's current political environment. You're the director, so you're the one that had to either decide I'm playing to it or not playing to it, and I felt like you played to it.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I think that the it's any great piece of theater, I think, speaks to the time, three things: the time it's set in, the time it was written, and the time that you're performing it. And sometimes two of those things are the same, and, you know, or three sometimes. And I think in this case, it's really interesting in that, like you said, it was a musical that was written in the 1990s, adapted from a book written in the 70s about the turn of the century, but we're doing it now. I think it really speaks to all those eras. And I think in some ways now is the most relevant time to be doing it, perhaps more than even when it was first written. It's, you know, if you look at everything that happens in the play, you know, every single one of them could be happening right now today, from, you know, the way that we treat immigrants in our country to the to the current issues of dealing with people's views of women, women's rights, and women in the workplace, to you know, to the way the deep-seated racism that we're still seeing and police violence against Black people, and it really speaks to where we're living today. And something that we felt really strongly about was not trying to hit people over the head with that, because to us it just feels so obvious
right.
that it is so relevant to today, and that by just doing the play and setting it in the time and putting the stories forward, that would speak for itself more than if we, you know, tried to modernize it in some way. But I think one of the more jarring things is that it is so specifically set in, you know, 1902 to 1917, but she could be today if you did it in modern dress.
Yeah, I think of Hamilton, where Lin-Manuel Miranda uses the line, "Immigrants, we get the job done." At the time he wrote that, you know, that doesn't have the resonance it has today. That part of that is just the way things go in time and politically. The show Ragtime is presented by the Griffin Theater Company. It's at the Den Theater, which is on Milwaukee, and kind of at 1333 North Milwaukee Avenue. I had dinner ahead of time. Lots of different places to eat around there. It's kind of nice to be in that neighborhood. Sort of Wicker Park there. Isn't that where we are?
Yeah, right in the heart of it.
Yeah.
A lot of my favorite restaurants are around there. It's great.
And the show is actually playing now, and it's playing now. You tell me if there's been an extension. July 16th is the date I believe it closes. Is it any longer than that, maybe?
As of right now, July 16th, but who knows?
All right, so the best way to do that is go to the website, griffintheater.com, and theater is spelled the correct way, the British way, T-R-E, at the end. griffintheater.com, playing now through July 16th. Maybe it'll get extended. It sure should. By the way, Chris Jones, who I respect so much at the Tribune, and have him on the podcast from time to time, he agreed with me. I tell Chris, I said, you know, Chris, you and I agree about 95% of the time, and he said, in the other 5%, Paul, you're wrong. But on this, we both agree. This is such an incredible show. Ragtime is incredible, but so impressed with the level of production that you guys were able to do in a small space, in a comfortable space. It made it such an intimate experience, and I congratulate both of you, both on incredible direction, incredible performance.
Thank you so much, Paul. It's a joy to talk to you, man.
Scott Weinstein, Jason Richards, don't miss them. Check it out. GriffinTheater.com. Ragtime, one of the best musicals ever written. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's P-A-U-L-L-I-S-N-E-K. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And, hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.